Turn my phone off. All right. Good morning. Glad to see all of you. I'm going to finish up Ezekiel this morning. Can you believe it? We did rush. It's 48 chapters. You got to rush unless you want to just say, okay, we're going to do this for three quarters. But if you got a worksheet, what we'll do is we'll just go through quickly and fill out the blanks, and then we'll come back and talk and discuss. And anything you've got that you want to talk about regarding Ezekiel that we haven't talked about yet, that's when we'll get to that. All right. Welcome, by the way, to everybody online. We're glad you guys are in this class with us, too. And I think Hal has made the worksheet available for you. So, the overall message of Ezekiel is that God will accomplish his will in spite of Israel's rebellion and the perceived power of nations. From 1 to 48, that's basically the message, at least that I get out of reading it, that God has sent his prophet to the exiles to let them know God has not forsaken you. Here's why you're being punished. Here's what's going to happen in the future. You're going to be restored. All those things. So that's the basic message of Ezekiel. The second line, the main issues pointed out for which God punished Israel were two things. What was one of them that would go in the first verse or the first blank? Okay, abominations, but abominations in what particular form? What's another word for the things they were doing? Debauchery. I like that word. And it was, but there's another word, more specific. Idolatry. Idolatry. That's what we're looking at. The worship of idols. And the other one, and by the way, you can look up these passages and it'll give you all this stuff. Idolatry, and in the second line, violence. Violence. They were doing violence to one another. So it wasn't just that their religion, their practices of religion were messed up and they had forsaken God, but they had forsaken God in the way they were treating one another as well. That reminds me, I shouldn't do this, but when I think of things that are relevant, I think, well, maybe I should go ahead and go to the prophet Micah. And Micah is relevant to the same time period. Look what he says in chapter 6. This is with regard to violence, idolatry also, but mostly violence. Micah chapter 6. Somebody read 6 through 8 for us if you've got it. Who's got that and wants to read? All right, Jake.
With what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God?
All right, what does the Lord require of you? Those three things at the end. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. And look what he made a reference to in verse 7. Shall I present my firstborn? One of the things that Israel was doing in the midst of their idolatry was offering up their children in the fire to Molech. So these prophets, they got their message from the same source. It was all God. Micah, you tell them this. Ezekiel, you tell them that. Jeremiah, you tell them this. All these messages were coming to the people of Israel because of their faithlessness, and they were all pointing them back in the same direction. So the idolatry is addressed, but the violence is also addressed. What's God require of you? Offer up your firstborn? No, not even 1,000 rams. What's he require of you? To love justice, to do kindness, to walk humbly with your God. Those are the things God requires. Still thing, same things today. All right. Important points in Ezekiel's message. Number one, God said, based on what he would do, they shall blank that I am the Lord. They shall know. That might seem elementary, but I want to make that point because God made that point through Ezekiel. You're going to see what I do, and when you see what I do, you're going to know that I'm the Lord. What was the question Pharaoh asked? Who is God that I should let his people go? And from that point on, God showed him so that Pharaoh found out who God was. Number two, God shows us his four severe judgments. And this is from chapter 5, verses 16 to 17 and 14, 21. Number one is famine. Number two, wild beasts. Number three, Brandy. The sword. That's number three. Or that's number four. What's number three? The plague. Plague, any plague. Lots of plagues. So when I watch the news and I see these things happening to nations today, including us, I wonder, is this just life going on as usual, or is this God coming in a judgment on us or some other nation? Number three, there will be a blank left of Israel. A remnant. There's always a remnant. That's what Noah and his family were. They were a remnant. That's what Joshua and Caleb were coming out of. Why do I say they were a remnant? Of all those that came out of Egypt, only two, the little remnant of Joshua and Caleb, made it into the promised land. Not even Moses. That doesn't say anything about the disposition of their souls. It just says there's a punishment for that, for being faithless. Number four, they will be judged according to their ways. So what should that do for us, for you and me? Make us take a look at our ways. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the ways thereof are the ways of death. That always makes me ponder. Well, then how do you know if the way that seems right? Well, it's not what seems right. It's what the Lord says. If you read it in the book, then you know. And that's what he's always expecting us to do and wanting us to do, is come to him for the right way, for the right knowledge, for the right information. How do I live, Lord? How do I treat people? How do I think in my head about this or about that? Number five, the blank will be marked. This is from chapter 9. The righteous. Remember in chapter 9, God showed Ezekiel the six destroyers. And among the six destroyers was a seventh man. What did he have? The inkhorn. The destroyers had destroying weapons. It doesn't describe them, just said destroying weapons. That's all we need to know. That's the way a lot of prophecy is. It's representative. But the man with the inkhorn was supposed to go through before the destroyers went through and mark everybody who... Do you remember what the qualifications were? They sighed and cried. They groaned over the evils of Israel. All right, Brandy, you're going to have to be quiet from here on out. Now, if I make Brandy be quiet, what's that mean for the rest of you? You got to speak up. You got to speak up, or else I'm going to turn her loose again. Number six, the blank of God leaves the blank. The glory of God leaves the temple. This was extremely significant. Do you remember what happened in Exodus when Moses and the Israelites completed the tabernacle? Brandy's got to be quiet, so now Judy's going to pick up. So, what happened? What did God do with the tabernacle as soon as it was complete? He filled the tabernacle with his glory so that not even Moses or anybody could be in there. They all had to get out because God filled it with his glory. That's from Exodus. Let's go back and read that real quick. Well, that was when on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, only the high priest could go in. Let's see. Where is it here? Where is it? 40:34. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, right where I was looking there. How come I didn't see it? Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So that's what happened as soon as they built it. God filled it with his glory, and now they don't have a tabernacle, they've got a temple, but because they are so evil and wicked, God is showing through his prophet Ezekiel that he is leaving the temple. His glory is leaving the temple. Number 7, the blank shall not bear the blank of the Father. Son shall not bear the word in English is iniquity. It means a continual unclean sin lifestyle, unclean. Yeah, that's what iniquity is. The son won't bear that. We didn't talk much about this, but this is one of the points in Ezekiel. He said, you've got this proverb, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. And he said, we're not going to say that anymore because the son will not bear the iniquity of the father. What denominational teaching does this eradicate? Sins are inherited, yes. Inborn sin inherited sin. There's a word for it, and I can't think of it. You're probably saying it, and I'm not hearing you. But it's the idea that we're born into sin. It's just not true. And when David said that, in sin did my mother conceive me? Well, I don't think so, because she was married, and that was good. That's what God said, go forth and multiply. He was speaking poetically. So we don't carry the sins of our parents. We carry our own sin. The soul that sins, is that the next one? It will die. The soul that sins will die. How reassuring would that have been to the people? God says, I'm coming in judgment. But first I'm going to go through and I'm going to mark everybody who's groaning over the sin of my people, because I want them preserved. And I want you to know that even if your father's a scoundrel, I'm not going to hold that against you. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon him. The wicked of the wicked shall be upon him. That's the teaching. Number 8. Failure of Israel's blanks, but that of the blank also. We did talk about this. Failure of Israel's leaders. They're leaders. Leaders in every fashion. The princes, the prophets, the priests, the shepherds. They all failed. But the failure also of the people. Just because your leaders fail to lead you in the right way is no excuse, in other words. You have a responsibility. What did Paul write to the church at Philippi? Work out whose salvation? Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. That didn't become true when Paul said it to the church at Philippi. That's always been true. Our relationship with God is on an individual basis. You're not saved because you're part of a group. You're saved because you're an individual with faith in God, and that faith makes you part of a group of the faithful. Yes?
That is in harmony with you will not bear the iniquity of your father.
Right.
Each and every one of us has an individual responsibility to be good stewards of our free will and come to God willingly. Otherwise, it just won't work.
Right. And it works both ways. If your father was a scoundrel, you don't bear his iniquity. But if your father was a saint, well you don't get any credit for that either. You've got to have your own faith. And that's an extremely important point for all of us to learn. Number 9, judgments over nations who were Israel's enemies. They were Israel's enemies. They sinned in the same way. They influenced Israel to sin. They persecuted Israel. And they might not have been the ones that carried them off into captivity, but they had something to do with the fall of Israel. And so God said, I'm going to punish them as well. Nobody's getting off scot-free here. Those who were guilty will suffer punishment, and that's what all these chapters are about. That's, if you take a look at it, it's chapter 22 through 34. Number 9, what am I looking at? I was looking at the wrong one. That's 25 through 32, I'm sorry, and there were other chapters that talk about judgment on nations. So that's number 9. All right, the last part of the first page, the reassuring message of restoration. And as you read, you'll find little pockets. This is what I'm going to do to take them down and punish them, and then there'll be a few, but I'm going to restore those who are righteous, and there's going to be a bright day coming, and things are going to get better. And then he goes back into a message of judgment. Remember, about how long was Ezekiel prophesying? How much time did his work span? Anybody remember? About 22 years from the text, about 22 years. Starts in the fifth year, got a reference to the 27th year, so that's 22 years at least. So over 22 years, he's giving message after message after message. A lot of those messages are about judgment. A lot of those messages are about restoration. A lot of those messages are about hope. They're similar messages interspersed. It's kind of like if you went to any congregation of the Lord's church and you looked at the sermons for a year, you'd see, oh, there's a sermon about hell. Oh, there's a sermon about salvation. Oh, there's a sermon about mercy. There's a sermon of grace. There's a sermon about judgment. It just runs the gamut because there's so many different messages that need to be preached based on who the audience is and what's going on. And so that's what we see in Ezekiel. The first arrow bullet point, the Valley of Dry Bones of chapter 37, signifies God will resurrect the nation so that his blank place shall be with them. Let's go to 37. This is one of those graphic visions with a point. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit. You wouldn't think the shadow of a microphone could mess up your reading, but it does if you're me. The hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me down in the middle of the valley, and it was full of bones. And he caused me to pass among them round about, and behold, there were very many on the surface of the valley, and lo, they were very dry. So you get the picture? The Spirit lifts him up and sets him down in this valley. What's the valley full of? Dry bones. And he's having him walk among these bones. And he said to me, Son of man, can these bones live? What does Israel say, or what does Ezekiel say by now? You know, because he has learned. don't think you know anything, just rest assured that God knows. He asks a question. Well, he's got a reason for asking that. Well, you know, Lord, if these bones can live. You ever find bones when you're walking around out in the woods or out in the fields? If somebody were to ask you, hey, think these bones laying here can live again? What are you going to say? Well, not until I take them home and paint them up and make a Halloween decoration out of them, and then maybe they'll kind of, no, they won't live again. But this is the question God puts to Ezekiel in this vision. He said to me, this is verse 4 of chapter 37, prophesy over these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God to these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter you that you may come to life. I will put sinews on you, make flesh grow back on you, cover you with skin and put breath in you that you may come alive, and you will know that I am the Lord. There it is again. You're going to know that I'm the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I prophesied, there was a noise, and behold, a rattling, and the bones came together, bone to its bone. And I looked, and behold, sinews were on them, and flesh grew, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. And then he said to me, prophesy to the breath, prophesy, son of man, and say to the breath, thus says the Lord God, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe on these slain, that they may come to life. Where had Israel been scattered to? To the four winds, and so he's bringing them back. So I prophesied as he commanded me, and the breath came to them. They came to life and stood on their feet, an exceedingly great army. And he said in verse 11, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They're coming back together. Not this miraculous way, but this is a message, a vision that is saying, I'm reestablishing this nation, this people again. That's what that's all about. All right. And you get to chapter 37. Look at verse 24 to 28. My servant David will be king over them. Whoa, hold on. Where's David? He's dead. What point did Peter make when he was preaching on Pentecost about David? We still have his sepulcher. And where are David's bones? On Pentecost, David's bones were still in the sepulcher. He was still dead. So why does the prophet say, why does God have Ezekiel to say, my servant David will be king over them? Who was Jesus? He was the son of David. God had promised David, from your loins, I'm going to raise up a king to sit on this throne. Well, there was an original fulfillment in Solomon and other kings who came from his loins. But the real fulfillment was in Jesus Christ. So we're getting a message. We talked about this last week. This is the message of the coming church, the coming kingdom. Just like Isaiah prophesied. In the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established where? In the tops of the mountains. That's what Ezekiel's going to be talking about. And Micah said the same thing. My servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd. They will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes and observe them. That's what the church does. That's not what Israel did, but that's what the church will do. They will live on the land that I gave to Jacob, my servant, in which your fathers lived, and they will live on it, they and their sons' sons forever. David, my servant, will be their prince forever, and I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant with them, and I will place them and multiply them, and will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My dwelling place also will be with them. And I will be their God and they will be my people. That's exactly the same thing that Jesus says at the end of the Revelation. I'm going to be with them. They're going to be my people. This has been God's desire from eternity, that the people he made would live with him, that there would be a fellowship and a closeness. And that's what he has done for us through Jesus Christ. He's made that possible, but we have to choose it. And Israel did not choose it, except for the remnant, the few, the ones marked in chapter 9. And that's where Jesus started in the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7. There are two ways Describe the ways. There's a narrow way. What's it lead to? Everlasting life. And there's a broad way that leads to destruction. And it's the same thing. It's always the same thing. All right. Gog and Magog from chapters 38 and 39 assure Israel that their enemies will not prosper over them. If you have ever read much or listened much about end time prophecies by denominational preachers, you have heard of Gog and Magog. And I remember Hal Lindsey. Anybody heard of Hal Lindsey? Okay. He wrote that 200 million Chinese would be coming across the Euphrates River on horses, and they'd be drinking Coca-Cola because nuclear war had evaporated all the water. And that this is the kind of stuff that you see in denominational interpretations of prophecy. But all this is about is, when you read it, let's see here, chapter 38. Verse 5, Persia. What was Persia before it was Persia? It was Babylon. Ethiopia, where's Ethiopia? Well, that's down south of Egypt. So we're going from way up here to Persia all the way down to Egypt. South of Egypt. And put with them, all of them, shield and helmet. Gomer with all his troops, These are the tribes that have made war against Israel, made their lives hard, made their lives bitter. And all God is saying is, it doesn't matter. Gog and Magog, they come against you. I'm going to preserve you through all this. And they won't have any lasting impact on you. That's what the message is here. I'm going to bring you through it. What did I put down here? Chapter 39, 21 to 29. I'll set my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see my judgment, which I've executed, and my hand, which I've laid on them. The house of Israel will know that I'm the Lord their God from that day onward. The nations will know that the house of Israel went into exile for their iniquity, because they acted treacherously against me. And I hid my face from them, and so I gave them into the hand of their adversaries, and all of them fell by the sword. According to their uncleanness and according to their transgressions, I dealt with them, and I hid my face from them. And then chapter 25, how's verse 25 start? Chapter 39, verse 25, how's it start? I'm going to restore. So this is what's happened. Israel sinned. I brought nations against them. I'm going to punish Israel through those nations, but then I'm going to punish those nations, and then I'm going to restore Israel. It's the same message over and over, just in different ways, different methods. Bless you. Remember when you were young and writing love letters to somebody? What's the old famous love letter? How do I love thee? How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. We all know that one. Why would you count the ways? Because there's a lot of ways to describe it. And that's the way it is with God. I'm going to tell you about the judgment I'm bringing. Oh, it's going to be like this. It's going to be like that. Here's another way I'm going to describe it. And over this 22-year period of Ezekiel's work, God had a lot of ways to give him to describe the coming judgment on Israel and on the nations, but also lots of ways to describe the restoration, the return. Did we fill in the blank on Gog and Magog? Their enemies will not prosper. Rule is good. And I'm making these up. I just make a blank to put a word in it that I think is the word I want to be there. You put your own word in there, but make sure it comes out of the scriptures in principle, at least. Their enemies will not prosper over them. What was God's intention with Israel from the get-go? What was the whole point of calling Abraham? Just stop and think about it. God says, I want to save the world. Here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to send my son into the world. How am I going to do that? Well, I'm going to create my own nation. And I'm going to create this nation from a guy who's past childbearing age. His wife's going to be 90 years old when she has that boy. And from that one boy, I'm going to bring into existence a nation. And from that nation, I'm going to bring into existence my son. But I'm going to give this nation a name. The boy's going to be called Jacob, eventually, the grandson. But what is he going to change Jacob's name to? What does Israel mean? He who struggles with God. And that's what God has done with this nation from the get-go. He has struggled with them to try to keep them on the straight and narrow. And they are rebellious and stiff-necked and hard-headed. They don't want to do it. And regardless of their rebellion, God works his will through them to save them and us. And we're off in some nation somewhere. God hadn't forgotten us. We were the Gentiles. But this is his plan. And so he's showing us through Ezekiel, I haven't forgotten my plan. This is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it in spite of you. If you want to be part of it, there's a remnant. They want to be part of it. Fantastic for them. But in spite of the rest of you who rebel, who fight, I'm still going to do it. You might as well sign on, be a lot better off. This is the sovereignty of God we're seeing in Ezekiel. This is the power of God. He says, I brought this nation into existence. Here's what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to send it off into exile in a foreign nation for 70 years. It's not even going to exist anymore for 70 years. And then what am I going to do? I'm going to bring them back. Who's going to pay for it? Well, Jesus eventually would pay for sin, but who's going to pay for the return of Israel to Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity? Cyrus. Cyrus, the Persian king, will pay for this. And when they get there, and they start rebuilding the walls, the local authorities who don't like them will start to complain, and they'll send word back to Cyrus. Hey, these Jews are coming. And Cyrus will say, I sent them there. You pay for it now with your tax money. Whoa. You think God doesn't have a sense of humor? And you think he doesn't know how to get his will accomplished in this world? So when I'm praying to God, this is how it works. I'm praying to God and I'm thinking, I don't know how you're going to get me out of this mess, Lord. I don't know how you can fix this. How can you help me? And God's like, are you kidding? Have you read what I've done with nations? And you're worried about me working in your life? Marty, get a clue. Get a clue. Father, I'm so bad, I'm so evil, my thoughts, I don't, why do I think the way they do it? God says, that's all I've ever worked with, Marty. You're just like everybody else in the world, except for the fact you want to be with me. You understand that my law is right, and you compare yourself with that, and you come up short. Everybody does. Everybody will, whoever compares themselves with my law. I sent my son to show you the greatest example. Does anybody come close to him? No, nobody does. So stop being down on yourself, put your faith in me, and let's go. And that's always been the message of God for individuals. Always been that same message. He wants us, and he's going to go to great lengths to make sure we have a way to get to him. And this is why he sends prophets. He could easily have said, I'm done with you guys. This is getting old. I've taken enough flack from you, you piddly little people. Don't you know who I am? But he doesn't do that. He says, I'm going to stay faithful for the sake of the faithful. And you're going to know that I'm the Lord. And the more blessed you are, the earlier you learn that. When you learn he's the Lord early in life, your whole life will be blessed by your knowledge of that fact. Doesn't mean everything will be easy. Just because God marked those, he showed us the marking of the righteous in Ezekiel chapter 9, doesn't mean that the lives of the righteous were easy from that time on. Where did Daniel find himself? Babylonian captivity. He had to go all the way from his homeland to a foreign land. And so did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So did Ezekiel. All the exiles. Where was Esther? She's a little bit later. She's in Persia. She's among the exiles because her uncle Mordecai had been taken with the exiles. Nehemiah, Ezra, all exiles. But it's a great story of God's unfailing faith. Bless you. Here we are. The back page. The detailed description of the blank and its service in chapters 40 through 48, I believe, is a foretaste of not only the restoration of the nation, but of the coming blank. So the description of the blank, temple. Have you read these chapters? How detailed? It starts out with God introducing Ezekiel to a guy with a measuring stick. And he measured every detail of the temple and the sacrifices and everything. Why in the world would he do that? My best guess is that he's trying to get the exiles to see, I'm serious about this. This isn't some pie in the sky thing. I've got a vision, God says, for my people. And it's detailed. And it's fantastic. And it's perfect. And that's what he has for us. And he relates it to us by showing us this vision of the temple being measured. By the way, what was happening to the temple in Jerusalem? The actual temple that was there, the physical temple, I should say. What was happening to it? What were the Babylonians doing to it? They were tearing that baby down. They besieged Jerusalem. They tore it down. That's why Nehemiah and Ezra tell the story about them going back to rebuild the walls around Jerusalem and the temple. They rebuilt the temple first. That's what they started on. Then they did the walls. They had to go back and rebuild it because it was being torn down. But Ezekiel is given a vision to give Israel of this guy with a measuring rod, heavenly being, measuring out the temple in all of its details. Has God's dwelling place ever been really in Jerusalem? Where does he want to live? In us, in your heart, and in my heart. That's his dwelling place. He doesn't care anything about temples. That's exactly right. David said, I want to build a house for you. And God said, did I ask you to build me a house? God turned it around and said, I'm going to build you a house. And that's why we read about David. David's going to rule over them. Well, David's dead and in the grave. Yeah, but Jesus isn't. Jesus isn't, and David is the offspring of David. He's the downline. Oh, what's the last blank? Church. The church. All this is a foreshadowing of the coming church. God's always got the end in mind. All right, under that one, there's A, chapter 43, 10 through 12. God told Ezekiel to make this plan known to the exiles who were, and if you go there, so he's shown you all these detailed measurements of the temple. And this is 43:10. As for you, son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the plan. If they are, there it is again, if they are ashamed of all that they have done, what did Jeremiah say about shame? When Jeremiah wrote about Israel, he said they've forgotten how to be ashamed. We live in a culture that in many ways has forgotten how to be ashamed. Things don't really change. They just cycle around. God told Ezekiel to make this plan known to the exiles who were ashamed of what they had done so that they would do it. And that's the rest of 10 through 12. Chapter 47. Go there. Still talking about the temple. Verse 1, he brought me back to the door of the house, and behold, water was flowing from under the threshold of the house toward the east. For the house faced east. Water was flowing down from under, from the right side of the house, from the south of the altar. He brought me out by the way of the north gate and led me around on the outside of the outer gate by way of the gate that faces east. And behold, water was trickling from the south side. Well, what was it doing? It was trickling from the south side. And when the man went outside toward the east with a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits, and he led me through the water reaching how deep? to the ankles. And he measured the 1,000 and led me through the water, water reaching to the knees. And again, he measured 1,000 and led me through water, water reaching to the loins, to the hips. Again, he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not ford, for the water had risen enough to... You see the gradual nature of this river flowing from the temple. Go to Isaiah. And we're going to read something from Isaiah that I believe is definitely... It's the same message, just in different words. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. It will come about that in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For the law is what's it going to do? It's going to go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So in Ezekiel, we see this river flowing. And you get down a little farther in chapter 47 of Ezekiel, and that river brings those two blanks, the last two blanks. Verse 9 of chapter 47, he says, it will come about that every living creature which swarms in every place where the river goes will live. This river is going to bring life. And in verse 12, by the river on its bank on one side and on the other will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither and their fruit will not fail. They will bear every month because their water flows from the sanctuary, and their fruit will be for food and their leaves for healing. So healing, life and healing and nourishment, all this from this river that flows out of the temple. Is it a literal river of water? No, of course not. What did God tell Abram in Genesis 12? I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make your name great. I'm going to make of you a great nation. And in you, all nations of the world will be what? Will be blessed. This is it. This is the same thing. It's the same message all the way through the Bible. God says, I want to bless humanity. I want to save humanity. I want to help humanity. I want to give them life and healing and nourishment. And what has Israel done? They've rebelled. They've worshipped idols. They've sacrificed their children to false gods. They've been violent to one another. And God says, all right, where's the ones that care about me? I'm going to save them, take them into a foreign land for 70 years, bring them back, going to reestablish Israel through Israel. I'm going to bring my son into the world. My son's going to establish the church. All the faithful will come into the church. All right, you got it? Say, Marty, we've had that forever. This is Ezekiel. Before that last bell rings, anybody got anything?
I did have a thought about the first class, and we're talking about basically God wants us to walk humbly, the passage we've read. And I think about Paul, and it's torn in the flesh, and God says, my power is perfected in weakness.
Right.
And we are living that as we go through life. God's given us a church to help support us and to give us an example of how to live. And if we do that, then that power is there. And the devil, he don't want that happening. He don't want us to realize how powerful we are with God.
Right.
And I don't know, I just, as you bring it through all the different references in the Bible and what happened in the Babylonian captivity and the remnants and here's what's going to happen and the prophecies, it just makes me think about that passage that you read earlier about walking and living humbly. You know, that's what God desires. Not all the sacrifices, not all the bulls, not all of this, this is what I want. And when we do that, and then he's given us a plan like what you described, to live that way, and we just see. And then we have to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, but it's in weakness that allows God's power to, you know, be perfected. And then we produce fruit. And I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's so easy to remember and see, and so easy to forget and to get distracted.
It is. Because we're just people. And what do we want for our children and our grandchildren? We want that. We just want them to live in love, to be at peace, to be strong, to be firm in their faith, to treat people with fairness and justice and kindness. That's what we want to see in our children. If they make a lot of money, well, that's great. Make a lot of money is good, but sometimes money is your downfall. We want the heart. We want to see our children's hearts right, and that's what God wants. It has never changed. It will never change. So, just like Solomon said in Proverbs, guard your heart with what? With all diligence, for out of it flow the issues of life. If they had done that, Ezekiel would never have had to write any of this stuff. Thank you. I appreciate it. You've been very patient.